Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with a former senior intelligence analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, who's now a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We're speaking with David McMichael about the efforts on the part of the 9/11 families and the 9/11 Commission to get a vote in the Congress on intelligence reform. And we'll be getting a view that's not often expressed, that is that this rush to reform intelligence actually may be completely misguided, and it's not such a question of a systemic failure, but the failure of individuals, none of whom have been held to account. So we'll be looking into that dimension of the debate, and we'll also speak with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who had lunch yesterday with Pakistani leader General Musharraf, who was visiting Washington. Ambassador Ahmed was the Pakistan's ambassador to the United Kingdom. He's the author of Resistance and Control in Pakistan, and he's the chair of Islamic Studies at American University. Then we'll talk about the recount or the efforts to clarify the voting in Ohio with Susan Truitt, who's the co-founder of Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. She is also an attorney, and tomorrow she'll be challenging the results of the election in Ohio before the Ohio Supreme Court. And then finally, we'll speak with Stephen Hertzberg, who's the founder of VoteWatch US, which has been a group that he started that's been monitoring the November elections and have identified a number of significant problems throughout the country. And we'll be talking to him about the more systemic problems with voting in this country. I'm speaking with David McMichael, who's a former senior intelligence analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency and a member of the steering committee of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. And David, I just, in the opening, was paraphrasing to some extent what I think we're going to be talking about here, which is not often heard, given that most people praise the bipartisan nature of the 9/11 Commission, and the families, of course, of the victims are given due respect. But you feel, and a number of other senior intelligence people feel, that this whole process is somewhat misguided. How do you distinguish yourself, your opinions, say, from Duncan Hunter and John Sensenbrenner, who are allegedly the villains in the piece, the ones that are holding up this congressional vote, which, if it did go to the floor, of course, it would be passed?
Yeah, well, Duncan Hunter, of course, on the Armed Forces Committee, is very interested in protecting the Department of Defense, which, as many of your listeners know, controls approximately 80% of the overall intelligence budget, which is a separate item, by the way, in the Defense Appropriation Act every year. So, yeah, there's a lot of turf protection that is going on.
And Sensenbrenner is concerned about immigration or the lack of immigration restrictions in the bill.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I think that would come under the heading of writers, I suppose, and not go to the essentials of the,
right,
the restructuring. And I think the one way to look at this, we refer to this as the intelligence reform bill. What it is a structural reorganization of the intelligence system. And I do very much sympathize with, because I've spoken with some of them, the survivors groups from 9/11 who want very much to, quote-unquote, see something done.
Right, and today a group of the survivors are meeting at Ground Zero at the World Trade Center, mm-hmm, to lobby to get this bill out of the gridlock or the deadlock that it's in.
Yeah. Well, I'll also say, Ian, about the bill, the centerpiece of the structural change, the reform, if you wish, is that a new national intelligence director will be established, who will report, as the current director of Central Intelligence does, to the President of the United States, but he will not also be, as the current Director of Central Intelligence is, also the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and that's been part of the argument here, is that a person who is saddled with, if you will, the responsibility for managing a very large and rather complex and by now agency, which by now over 60 years has developed a very strong culture of its own with lots of little pieces of turf to defend, is that that man should not be responsible also for directing, and in fact it's not so much directing as negotiating with, the other powerful agencies which are go to make up what we call the intelligence community. So in a certain sense, this gets back to the original idea of the National Security Act of 1947, in which the CIA was established, that it would be essentially a rather small group of people under a director whose responsibility would be to coordinate and receive all the information coming in from the established branches of United States intelligence in the military, in the Department of State, the FBI, and elsewhere, and do basically one thing, threat assessment. See, was there an immediate and imminent danger to the United States, and to be able to define it and report on it directly to the President of the United States. And the mantra at that time was no more Pearl Harbors, mm-hmm. just as we hear today, no more 9/11s.
Well, but specifically, it seems that, first of all, the one of the main so-called reforms is to make the Director of Central Intelligence really the Director of Central Intelligence, to have control over the other agencies, some 15.
Well, that's the National Intelligence Director.
Right, but the point is that the DCI
will not be the Director of Central Intelligence.
I understand,
but
there has been in the past, when Stansfield Turner was the director, mm-hmm. he got an executive order ordering all the other agencies to basically to listen to him. Or
That's absolutely correct.
So it's been done before. I mean, the thing that I wanted to get to is first of all, we got a new director of Central Intelligence whose first memo he sends out to everybody is you got to be loyal to the president. At the same time, the White House is saying that they're afraid that the CIA is going to be guilty of groupthink. I mean, when in fact the administration is ordering them to think as a group and to be loyal and essentially follow the
yes.
White House.
Well,
one issue. The second issue, though, is that I understand that a lot of intelligence professionals believe that the 9/11 Commission missed the entire point, that they have come up with what they consider to be systemic failures and have not addressed the real failures, which were the failures of individuals. And you can name the culprits. Louis Freeh, perhaps the most culpable, the head of the FBI, whose first thing when he took over the FBI was to get rid of all the computers and take the computer off his desk. He was completely blind.
That's known as old school.
And then you've got George Tenet, who is basically mm-hmm. a liaison guy, not a former intelligence officer in any traditional mm-hmm. sense, more of a political guy.
Well, George Tenet, to comment upon specifically that point, George Tenet had been a congressional staff person
right.
for 20-plus years and with the intelligence committees, yes. So he
and then he did nothing. He basically eventually resigned, and now is making $50,000 a pop, telling tales out of school to select audiences on the lecture circuit. Then you've got Condoleezza Rice, who's clearly out of her depth, and then you've got George Bush and Dick Cheney. I mean, none of these people have been held accountable.
No, they have not. And it's in a certain sense, you can say that if there has been one person held accountable in the sense of being a fall guy, it has been George Tenet, and he deserved it, in my opinion. But you're right. There have not been individuals anywhere up and down the chain held accountable. One example that I would like to give, you mentioned Louis Freeh and the FBI, is the specific officers, mid and upper mid-level officers in the FBI, who absolutely refused to pass on the information gained most specifically at the Minneapolis office, where the flight training and intentions of the two individuals who were among the 9/11 bombers had come to the attention of the field office, and their superiors simply refused to pass it on or even to seek a court authority to conduct searches of these individuals.
Now, was the fix in with the 9/11 Commission? Was that the deal from the beginning, that no heads are going to roll?
Well, there were a couple of people on the committee, and I'll name one, Richard Benvenisti particularly, who I think would have been very glad to see some heads roll. But it was put together in a very careful, and you said earlier, bipartisan way to pretty much ensure that nothing of that nature would be done. I think one of the interesting aspects of that, when we look and find the role played by former Secretary of Defense and also former head of the CIA, James Schlesinger, in these terms, and go back and look to 30 years ago, when Jim Schlesinger took over the Central Intelligence Agency in the midst of the Watergate disclosures, and announced very strongly to his staff that he was here to see that nobody was going to screw Richard Nixon, mm-hmm. and that he reported, not to the not to Henry Kissinger, who at the time was the National Security Advisor, but to Bob Haldeman, who was Richard Nixon's the Karl Rove of the day, you might say.
Yeah, well, that didn't seem to affect Deep Throat, though, did it?
Yes, whoever he was.
Right. Well, the rumor is that he came from the CIA. But so, just in closing, then, David McMichael, again, your former senior intelligence analyst with the Central Intelligence Agency and a member of the Steering Committee of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Is there any chance that some of the stuff that we've been talking about and that you're interested in getting across to the public is ever going to have any traction here? Because essentially you've got these two congressional chairs that are carrying the water for the Pentagon for bureaucratic and turf reasons, and you've got the general impression in the public that the 9/11 Commission was an exemplary demonstration of bipartisanship, and the book that they put out is a bestseller. It's actually very well written, as a matter of fact. Then you've got the families demonstrating. So it just seems like some of the real issues that we're talking about here just aren't getting out there.
Well, I think in terms first, Ian, of accountability of individuals and separate offices within the intelligence system, with the events around 9/11 and the events leading up to the invasion of Iraq, there is not going to be, at least under this administration, and given the way the American system operates. I mean, Iran-Contra has long since been swept under the rug, has it not?
No.
And one finds, let's take an Elliot Abrams, who was one of those convicted in that affair, is not only a leading member of the foreign policy team of this administration, but to take it one step further, here's a guy who's licensed to practice law in New York and the District of Columbia, and not even the bar associations of these have taken any action against him. So that's one part of it in terms of holding individuals to account for what were and are continuing to be very serious failures in the gathering and interpretation and presentation of intelligence. The second affair, which is, again, long ongoing, and certainly the always agitated Alexander Coburn expresses it very well in the current issue of The Nation, is to say people are suddenly saying we're shocked to find that politics enters into the conduct of the United States intelligence system. And all I need say to you is the name of the man under whom I worked, William Casey, who went from being Ronald Reagan's campaign director to being the director of Central Intelligence. All I need to mention to you is the name of the father of the current president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, who went from being chairman of the Republican National Committee in the aftermath of the Church and Pike investigations to being the director of Central Intelligence. Now, these people had a very political role to play, and they played it very hard. So the system staggers on. It does some good work. It gathers a lot of information. It presents it often very, very well. And then it comes into the hands of people who are controlling policy and will act upon that information. And that's where we all need to do a little prayer and fasting.
And just in closing, do you think there's going to be a vote this week?
That I can't say.
I'd say no, but that's just my bet.
My guess is that it's probably not. There's only a 2-day session this week.
Yeah, that's right.
I doubt they get to it this week, but there's always another Congress coming along.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David McMichael.
Okay, thank you for having me, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with David McMichael. He's a former senior intelligence analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. He's now a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, and we're talking about the efforts to bring about intelligence reform and whether indeed the reform is misplaced. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is formerly Pakistan's ambassador to the United Kingdom and chair of Islamic Studies at American University, and he's the author of Resistance and Control in Pakistan. And yesterday, after a meeting with President Bush, you met General Musharraf met with you and a group of people in Washington for lunch. And first of all, I guess he was wearing a suit, right?
He was wearing a suit, and I think after the meeting, his confidence was replenished and renewed, because the burning issue in Pakistan, of course, is the issue of the uniform. And I think with the kind of very strong and positive response that Bush gave him in terms of support for what he's doing. For the time being, the signals are that he can be confident of his position.
But it seems, though, obviously the subtext has always bin Laden, and bin Laden, of course, emerged shortly before the election in a videotape and followed a little time later by the number two, al-Qaeda, Zawahiri. And this, of course, has brought him back on the front burner, as it were. And it seems to me that the United States has kind of outsourced its getting bin Laden account to Pakistan. And so where does that stand?
Well, it can't do very much more, because remember, it is Pakistan which has troops on the ground. It is Pakistan that knows the area, the languages, the customs, the culture, and so on. And if anyone can get bin Laden, it would have to be Pakistani troops, because American troops aren't even really operating on this side of the border. They are mainly on the Afghan side of the border. And there's an area called the tribal areas in between, which is very difficult to penetrate for either army. So in that sense, yes, Pakistan has to play a very key role in capturing bin Laden. At the same time, what I found very interesting was that President Musharraf gave an interview to Paul Azan in which he said categorically that bin Laden is not in Pakistan. And early on, if you recall, there was a statement that he was, or there was a high-value target in the tribal areas of Pakistan. So there was an element of contradiction there.
Well, that high-value target they're referring to was when the last offensive took place.
That's right. It was the number two man, Ayman al-Zawahiri.
Right. And he, needless to say, slipped away. You were the government agent for that area,
yes,
were you not?
Yes, I was, in fact, in charge of South Waziristan Agency. That is the agency that President Bush referred to yesterday when he talked of Waziristan, where possibly bin Laden is hiding.
And, of course, it's worth noting that this is a kind of a no-man's land that goes back to the British occupation. For 80 years, the British Army tried to subdue that area and finally gave up.
Yes, it's a turbulent area, a very difficult terrain, high mountains, deep valleys, very remote, inaccessible areas. And two of the toughest tribes in that part of the world, I mean really tough tribes who've taken on, forget the British previous empires, and certainly in no mood to allow any contemporary political governments to steamroll over them. So the military action has created some resentment in the area. There have been deaths, there's been firing and so on. So government has to be very cautious, tread carefully, so use the military option, but also try diplomacy, which is, I believe, what's happening now.
But what about a third thing, which is, in other words, instead of sending in armies, and in this case, having the special forces sort of on the other side of the border, the U.S. special forces, why not send in humanitarian aid, build roads, introduce utilities and communications?
Exactly. I would say, well, when I was in charge, that was the most effective strategy, what you just suggested. I found that, for instance, I was the first political agent ever to get to the actual border itself, which is where I suspect this fellow is hiding, if he's there at all, a completely inaccessible, very wild part of Waziristan. And I found that there was nothing. They did not even have a medical dispensary, no school, nothing. So I donated these schools on behalf of government to school, a dispensary and so on. And that immediately began the process of change in a positive way, which integrated that part of the agency to the rest of the agency. That has to be the way, and I believe that that is one agent of change that local people would also welcome.
Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, you mentioned that General Musharraf, in an interview with Paul Azan on CNN, suggested that bin Laden was not in the area and therefore was somewhere else. And many people, when they saw the recent videotape, thought that he looked sort of tanned and rested and perhaps living in a palace in Saudi Arabia or somewhere, but certainly not in a remote part of the world that you've just described, where kidney dialysis machines would have to be taken up mountain peaks, etc.
Yes, but also remember that although these areas are inaccessible, we call them inaccessible in political terms. So if they wanted someone to have access or to welcome someone, that person could be welcome, and then everything would be available. So it wouldn't be such a problem getting a machine up to that part of the world, or even videos and cameras and so on, and to set up a room that looks like a posh hotel in Karachi or Dubai, something could be easily arranged. You could have a backdrop and you could have a podium and so on, and it would allow Osama to give his speech as if he was speaking from some conference room. So I'm not so convinced simply on the basis of that performance.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, you know, here in Hollywood, they know how to do that kind of thing.
Simulation, exactly. They can create things through the imagination.
But let's just, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, again, you're the author of Resistance and Control in Pakistan, formerly the Pakistan's ambassador to the United Kingdom and the chair of Islamic Studies at American University. Do you think that, the perpetual question one always hears is that Pakistan is hanging by a thread, the Islamists are making steady inroads, and one of the things that seems to be missed in all of this is that there has been democracy, there has been civilian rule, and invariably the United States finds itself supporting military rulers. And you're a civilian.
This is a very important point you raise, because and this certainly comes up, because if the United States is not only supporting but seen to be supporting a military rule, which essentially this is President Musharraf, because he's also the commander-in-chief of the Pakistan Army and continues to be and has every intention of staying on. The people of Pakistan are very ambiguous about this particular position of the United States. So while they applaud the help and assistance and the special status that Pakistan is enjoying, they're also very uncomfortable with the implications of this support. So the whole question of democracy becomes an important one, particularly when President Musharraf's deadline for giving up the uniform or the office, one of the offices which he had promised to give up by December, that deadline approaches. Now, there's a lot of activity which is being reported by the Pakistani press that people are in touch with Benazir Bhutto, people are in touch with Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, so that there's some kind of political negotiation taking place, and so there's some kind of arrangement may emerge in the next couple of months which would satisfy all parties so that Pakistan moves towards more of a genuine democratic path than it is at the moment.
But the thing, the disconnect that I see is that here we are allegedly bringing democracy to Iraq when it's clearly backfired or it's not exactly achieving the results of the architects. At the same time, we're tolerating a military rule in Pakistan. And then on top of that, we are now poised to sell a bunch of F-16s to Pakistan and a Patriot missile system to India because the United States is worried that the Israelis are going to sell the Arrow system. So they're probably discounting the Patriot. So here we are, we've got an arms bazaar going in this part of the world where recently there was a nuclear standoff. So it doesn't strike me as particularly, it seems sort of counterintuitive in a way.
Well, you're right, because one of the criticisms about America abroad is precisely this. Americans are constantly surprised why people don't like them. The fact of the matter is that they're wrong. People do like them. Americans are popular. American foreign policy is not very popular. And this is an important distinction to be made. So I've just come back from the United Kingdom, and this thing was coming up again and again, exactly this discussion that Americans in themselves are always warm and generous and very friendly people, as distinct from American foreign policy, which is seen very often as supporting dictators or ruthless tyrants and so on. If you look at the map of the world, you see very often Central Asia, for instance, another example, adding to the examples you gave. So the quandary that I believe the United States finds itself is this, that how do you pursue this war on terror if without the alliances that need to be built up to pursue the fugitives that are on the run, and at the same time balance it with promoting democracy. Now, I believe that ultimately it has to be weighted towards democracy, because once you start compromising that, you're on the slippery slope and you're actually giving signals to the world that it's okay to persecute your people as long as you're a friend of the United States of America. So in short, you are in fact compromising the greatest virtue associated with the United States, which is the practice and promotion of democracy.
And just in terms of the Pakistani domestic scene, how I understand that the war in Iraq has deeply damaged the attitudes towards the United States, and particularly amongst the sort of pro-Western educated classes, they're finding it more and more hard to support America. And in other words, the very people that we need in that part of the world, we seem to be alienating and marginalizing.
Well, again, you're right, because the strength that the United States has abroad are people who, as you say, are westernized or educated or urban-based, people who generally would associate democracy, human rights, civil liberties with the United States. And the continuation of the war in Iraq and the manner in which it is being fought, and remember all these terrible images that we see from time to time in the American media of mosques being blown up or people being shot to death in a mosque or being tortured and so on. These are flashed on the front pages and on television sets throughout the Muslim world. And they cause a great deal of revulsion and anger. So something that began a year back, maybe by small groups of disaffected people, is now swollen up and supported by many, many, many more people. And this will continue to grow. So you're seeing a situation which is, to my mind, absolutely unacceptable, which is every day now American soldiers are dying and Iraqis are dying in great numbers. Every day this is happening. So, and it's not in one spot, one location, it's happening in half a dozen spots at the same time. So the effort to win the hearts and minds of this part of the world, that effort needs to be really redoubled, re-energized, and all our imagination, all our strength, all our resources seem to be should be put in that effort.
But unfortunately, in the real world, as much as the President Bush talks about elections in January in Iraq and that, you know, the insurgency is a bump in the road to democracy, it seems that the situation, and we were talking about it with the former New York Times analyst Yusuf Ibrahim in the second hour, who's in Dubai and who's spent some time in Iraq recently. The impression you get is that it's actually getting worse there, and that perhaps that's one of the reasons why the administration is so anxious to get this election over with, because if they postpone it, conditions on the ground are just going to get worse. So
it can spin out of control. The analogy I have in my mind is the analogy with 1947 India, when India was partitioned by the British. Now, they had a similar dilemma. The longer they stayed, the messier it got, the more the killings. They partitioned India, and if you recall, about 2 million people were killed and about 15 million transferred populations, Hindus running away from Pakistan and coming to India, and Muslims from India to Pakistan. Now, here you have a different situation. You've got the Shia-Sunni divide, and a fairly clear divide. So you see that the Sunnis are unhappy about the elections. The Shia, on the other hand, want the election. This shows how complicated the situation is on the ground. So if you push through elections, you will have, well after the elections, continued resistance against the results by the Sunni belt. Therefore, it's important that if the elections have to be held, the majority population, the Shia, should be firmly on board, particularly their great religious leaders like Sistani, Ayatollah Sistani. These people should be clearly, unequivocally, and publicly standing squarely behind the idea and practice of the elections.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who was Pakistan's ambassador to the United Kingdom, and he's now the chair of Islamic Studies at the American University in Washington, D.C., and the author of Resistance and Control in Pakistan. And now we'll talk about another election, the recent election here in the United States, and particularly in the state of Ohio, where there is a challenge to the results. There were demonstrations yesterday in Columbus and other parts of Ohio. And our guest, Susan Truitt, is the co-founder of Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. She's also an attorney, and she's going to be challenging the results of the election before the Ohio Supreme Court tomorrow. And what ammunition do you have, Susan?
Good morning, Ian. Thank you for having me. The lead attorney on the case that will be filed tomorrow is Cliff Arnebeck, and I am one of the attorneys assisting him on the case. We are claiming that the basis to file a contest to the election under Ohio law, it will be filed before the Ohio Supreme Court. And one of the bases that we have are the huge anomalies in the votes as tallied, including there was a little-known judge candidate named Ellen Connolly who lost her bid for the Ohio Supreme Court. She was a Democrat. And yet, in many counties down around the Cincinnati area, she received up to 45,000 votes more per county than John Kerry did, which is very hard to believe that somebody who is going to be voting for a Democratic judge candidate would not be voting for John Kerry. And this anomaly that we see between the votes between Ellen Connolly and John Kerry holds consistent throughout almost all the counties in the state.
So she was handily reelected to the Supreme Court, and she'll be hearing
She lost, but in all of these counties, she received more votes than John Kerry, which is fallaciously hard to believe. You know, how could a losing judge candidate receive more votes than John Kerry when she's a Democrat, practically across the board throughout the state? So it's our position that the votes were taken from John Kerry and given to Bush.
And I mean, obviously, what are you going to present, though, in terms of evidence? I mean,
the statistical data, and of course, just the request to examine all of the electronic voting machines, the tabulations, the punch cards. We will be dissecting this election. This is different. suspend the recount, which is still in process and is still important, that is being preceded by the Green Party and the Libertarian Party being represented by John Bonifaz of the National Voting Rights Institute. Mm. Our lawsuit is different in that a contest to the election will actually look at the underlying documentation of the election and the supporting documents of how they came up with their vote tallies.
And will you get access to, and what will you be getting access to? I mean, is there, this is a county-wide system, and there's no uniformity. So do you have are there professional people that can do this kind of thing that are nonpartisan?
The advantage to filing a contest to the election is it opens up the discovery process. We're not going to be on a fishing expedition. We have enough evidence, we feel, to indicate fraud now, but it will give us the opportunity to do discovery and to obtain documentation and testimony and depositions and things which will shed even further light on the vote anomalies in Ohio.
Well, I believe already the recount, as it's progressed, it hasn't been certified, but I think they've added, 15,000 votes to Kerry's tally?
Yes, that's correct. So the vote margin is decreasing in Ohio between John Kerry and George Bush. And you're right, recount effort has not begun, and there was a federal court hearing on that on Friday. The Green Party was requesting that the judge waive the 7-day requirement that is necessary after a recount is filed, giving notification to the parties and the boards of election, which really is specious at this point. Everyone knows there's going to be a recount, but the judge would not waive the 7-day requirement. Secretary of State Blackwell has dragged his feet on this whole certification process. He will not certify the election until Monday and probably not until 5 o'clock, which means that the 7-day notice requirement won't begin until the next day, which means that the recount can't start until after that, which means, of course, it's all domino effect, that it will not start until after the Electoral College meets on December 13th.
Well, I'm certainly not a lawyer, but I recall in the Florida debacle back in 2000.
Yes.
The first thing that happened there was when Jim Baker and the Republican team came into the state, the first thing they did was they filed in federal court under the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, and people were kind of puzzled by that. But of course, at the end, it seemed to me it all led to the Supreme Court, and they found they used that 14th Amendment as the kind of legal framework for the decision. Let me ask you this though: wouldn't the 14th Amendment apply to the fact that, I mean, without getting into any conjecture about fraud, just let's deal with the bare facts that everybody saw on their television screens. Mm-hmm. Inner city, poor people, mostly African Americans, spent up to 12 hours and 20 hours lined up in the cold and rain to vote, whereas rural white people in Republican areas voted in 10 minutes.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have a clear pattern of discrimination in Ohio for voter suppression, and that's definitely part of the claim as well.
But isn't that a 14th Amendment issue?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely, Ian. And it's reprehensible that has occurred in this day and age. It was the imposition of Jim Crow laws. Challengers who were challenging mostly African-American voters regarding their right to vote. It was an equitable distribution of voting machines and voting apparatus in the state. There was voter intimidation. There was abject fraud of people going door to door saying, oh, Democrats are voting Wednesday, the Republicans are voting Tuesday. There were thousands of people in Ohio who did not have the opportunity to vote, primarily because of the long lines in inner city, low income, African-American neighborhoods.
Well, I'm puzzled, though, Susan, as to why the Democratic Party didn't see this coming. If the machines, and we remember after Florida, the Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, known as HAVA, and essentially what happened was that Tom DeLay got hold of all that money and made sure that the Republican areas got voting machines and the Democrats got fewer and the older ones. So was anybody aware of the fact? I mean, if you're an inner-city precinct that's largely African-American, is going to vote Democrat, and there are only two voting machines for thousands of people, didn't somebody see this coming and cry foul before?
Well, it's a good question. People were asking the boards of election officials in Franklin County in particular, in Columbus, Ohio, whether they were ready. We had county commissioners asking the boards of election, do you need more money? Do you need more money to buy any more machines? And the answer was always, no, we're ready. We can handle this increased registration. We can do this election. And so the answer from the boards of election in Franklin County, Ohio, was that they were ready, when in fact they were miserably inadequately prepared.
And that is, and they work under Blackwell, the right? Is he their boss?
Yes, that's correct.
And he's also the chair of the Republican re-elect Bush committee in the state of Ohio, isn't he?
Yes, that's correct. Our Secretary of State, Kenneth Blackwell, is the co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign in Ohio, and he has been an obstructionist with regard to this election for months and months, and the handwriting was on the wall that it was going to be a disaster. In fact, State Senator Teresa Fetter and State Senator C.J. Prentice called for Blackwell's resignation back in August or September, citing the fact that he had been an obstructionist with regard to voting technologies, with regard to registration issues, with regard to his opinion and directives regarding provisional balloting. He has made a mess of this election from the word go.
But if you're saying that that people were targeting Blackwell for incompetence and partisanship prior to the election, people had to know. I mean, every political analyst in this country knew that Ohio would be the key swing state. And as it turned out, Ohio was the deciding state.
Yes, that's correct. You're absolutely right. And there were those of us on the ground trying to raise red flags and trying to deal with these issues, including Senator Fetter and C.J. Prentice and activists in Case Ohio. And our efforts were successful in some regards and obviously not in others. There's only so much that the activists and a couple of state senators can do.
Well, finally, Susan, what do the citizens think of what you're trying to do? Do you feel that your fellow citizens in Ohio care?
I think that there's a contingency of Ohioans who care a great deal and are very passionate about this issue, and of course more and more since the election. There are smaller groups springing up throughout the state to deal with the post-election debacle, and there is a sense of unity but at the same time, there are still a number of Ohioans who do not see this as an issue, who think it's people being crying sour grapes and poor sports, which it isn't at all. This is not about John Kerry. This is not about George Bush. This is about our right to vote. It's about our voice, and it's about our democracy. It is nothing less than a threat to our democracy.
And there you were yesterday demonstrating in Columbus before the State House, near a statue of William McKinley.
Yes, that's correct.
The famous plutocratic president during the Gilded Age, whose tenure was rather short-lived. But many people say that we're going back to the Gilded Age, given the distribution of wealth in this country is concentrated in fewer hands.
Corporate-run domain.
Did you feel a little irony there with the bronze of McKinley behind you?
Yes, we did, as a matter of fact. And we were fortunate in having wonderful weather, and people turned out from California, so we're very grateful to the Californians who came out. Warren Linney, for instance, is staging demonstrations every day this week. He's from California. He will be in Columbus, Ohio all week, staging demonstrations at Secretary of State Blackwell's office at the Board and Building on East Broad Street in Columbus at 11 o'clock. And we are going to have another rally at the State House on December 12th and another one on the 13th. There's a website. It's 51capitalmarch.com. And it's urging everyone in every state to stage a demonstration on December 12th at their State House in each state in the country.
And as you, as it stands now, just to clarify what the process is here, tomorrow, Monday, you will be the Secretary of State is supposed to announce the recount results.
That's correct. No. I'm sorry. No, that's not correct. Tomorrow he will certify the vote.
Certify the vote. Yes, right. And
then he'll issue notification of a recount, and that probably won't go out until Tuesday, and that's a 7-day thing. And then the recount can begin after the 7-day notification, which means that it will, of course, be after the Electoral College meets on December 13th.
Well, I guess, you know, you've got your work cut out for you tomorrow there before the Supreme Court.
Yes, we do, thank you. But we feel very well prepared. We feel that the evidence is overwhelming that this election needs to be scrutinized, put under the microscope, and have all the spotlights on it and dissected, because it was a debacle from the start to the finish.
Well, thanks for joining us, Susan, and all the best tomorrow before the Ohio Supreme Court. And I guess the irony is that, you're saying it's not about John Kerry, because I think if you could find enough votes for John Kerry, there's no way that he could ever become president. He probably wouldn't want the job, would he, under those conditions?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to say. I certainly can't speak
okay.
for him. I would think, though, that if the results in Ohio are such that it's clear that he actually won the state, then the Electoral College shifts to him, and then he is the president.
Right.
And, if it occurs before the inauguration in January, I don't see any reason why John Kerry wouldn't be the next president.
Okay, well, we'll stay tuned, and I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye, Susan.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Susan Truitt, who's the co-founder of Citizens Alliance for Secure Elections. She's also an attorney, and tomorrow in the Ohio Supreme Court, she'll be challenging the results of the election. I'm now speaking with Stephen Hertzberg, who is the founder of Vote Watch US. And Stephen Hertzberg is a engineer, designer, technical program manager, and information systems developer who had spent a number of years in the Pentagon, and has formed this small organization to try and do something about what appears to many, particularly around the world, to be a dysfunctional voting system in this country. First of all, Stephen, why is it, you think, that the average American doesn't seem to understand that voting in the rest of the developed world is not a complicated process? It's easy, and it's transparent, and it's accurate.
Well, I think if most Americans are like I was 3 years ago, I would have thought the same thing. I don't think Americans realize the differences between our voting system and other voting systems around the world, or the differences between the voting system, say, in Ohio and the voting systems in California or Georgia. They vary greatly all over the U.S., and they vary greatly between the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. But I don't think many folks really think through this system. They have trust and they have faith in it. It's something they do every year, every 2 or 4 years. And from their perspective, it's usually a fairly simple and seamless process.
And why is it then that that all of that outrage after Florida, and the kind of international embarrassment that was felt here in this country? Many people sort of was talking about Florida being a banana republic, etc. A lot of money was spent through the Help America Vote Act to fix the system. But now we have all of these challenges, and you're in Ohio as we speak. So what happened? What went wrong?
Well, I think from an average citizen's perspective, the Help America Vote Act came into being a couple of years ago. A lot of money was allocated to fix the election system. I think a lot of people felt that Florida might be an anomaly. They certainly felt like the government was being responsible and taking action, certainly spending money, that election officials in their state were being responsible, and they probably felt that the problem was taken care of. And there really hasn't been, in the mainstream media, other than with respect to the electronic voting issue, which really only started being reported in the mainstream in March of this year after Super Tuesday, this issue has been largely mute in the mainstream media. And then once it became into being again, the focus was on electronic voting. You had a number of fringe nonprofit groups who were really making the loudest claims. And I'm not sure a lot of people really followed the issues closely from a holistic perspective or a system-wide perspective, which is really what you the viewpoint or the vantage point you need to take in order to understand what's going on with the election system. And it's not a simple, straightforward process, nor is it a simple, straightforward problem. This is a very complex issue, and that's I certainly have a tremendous amount of respect for the complexity of this issue, and I've gained that respect over the last 3 years.
But if it's it may be complex, but it should be simple.
Hey, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree that we have a complex system. We have many, we have hundreds, thousands of complex systems all across the U.S. I mean, counties are to a certain extent left on their own to develop their own system. And there isn't a national system or national set of standards which they really need to follow or even a set of best practices.
And there's no neutral party in this, is there? Every county, every state, and indeed the federal government under Tom DeLay, who was funneling out the money for the HAVA, for the Help America Vote Act, they're all deeply partisan.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think that is that's something for the American people to decide. But just let me just present the facts, and that is that the election system is run by thousands of election officials across the country. These election officials are party-affiliated. In some cases, they are elected. In some cases, they are appointed. VoteWatch, for example, is a nonpartisan organization. And we are regularly attacked for being partisan by both sides, actually, and it's been very difficult for us to maintain an appearance of nonpartisanship. It's been a major issue. We've worked very hard on it. But we, as a nonpartisan group, are in the position of observing partisan officials operating our election system. And I think, Americans should think about that and think whether the role should not be reversed, whether we should, in fact, have nonpartisan officials running our election system and having partisan officials observing it. It may not be a workable solution. I don't know yet. It's certainly up for it's up to the folks in each state to determine how this works, but I think it's a point for them to consider.
But Stephen Hertzberg, how much do you think that voter suppression is in the DNA of the American electoral process going back to the Founding Fathers? After all, the Founding Fathers valued the vote so much they didn't want to share it with anybody except white men of property. It took women 200 years to get the vote. African Americans in the South didn't get the vote till 1964. All of the hundreds of years of voter suppression in the South against the African Americans was the core of the Dixiecrats who used to be in the Democratic Party, and then after the Civil Rights Act of 64, they moved to the Republican Party, and now the Republican Party is effectively controlled by former Dixiecrats. So, at the risk of sounding cynical, it seems to me that there's as much a history of voter suppression in this country as there is of voter emancipation.
Agreed. I think you can learn a lot about this country, and I am certainly not an expert at it. I have advisors who are experts at election history, but I know, for example, when we had a large influx of immigrants coming into this country, one of the things that was implemented were English writing tests before you could vote. I mean, certainly there have been a number of tools that have been implemented over the years to control or change who could and who could not vote, certainly. But that's only one issue, and that seems, and again, we have to look at this from a system-wide perspective. One perspective is voter disenfranchisement. Were you able to vote? That's point one. The other point is how accurate and fair and transparent is the vote count? And I don't think enough people are focusing on that. That there is very little transparency, almost no transparency, into the process once you have cast your ballot. What happens to that ballot? Who sees it? How is it counted? Is it counted? Is it counted accurately? There are a number of issues, and that is something that we're heavily focused on.
Well, it reminds me of Joseph Stalin's remark, it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the vote.
Yeah, it was something like that, but yeah, similar. And I think it's, it's certainly an important issue, just as important as whether you were able to cast your vote or not. I mean, there are biases Well, let's put it this way. There could potentially be biases within the vote counting process. Right. That's one of the things that we are looking for, to see whether, you know, is the vote counted as accurately in, you know, one socioeconomic region of the country versus another? Or do we see vast differences? We don't know yet. Those are the things. One of the things we want to find out.
Well, it's clear that a growing sector of the public are very, very skeptical about the integrity of voting, particularly these new electronic voting machines. I've done a number of interviews with activists who believe that Diebold and other machines are essentially Republican voting machines. Obviously, you're trying to get to the heart of the matter, and it's obviously a tough road to hoe that you have. But the point I'm making is that the perception and the disquiet is already out there. So if people lose confidence in the system, that is in itself a form of disenfranchisement.
Well, you're absolutely right. Agree completely. We absolutely need transparency in the system. But let's not be unfair either. You know what? We as citizens, me included, I'll take a brunt of the blame. You know, I've been a lousy citizen for 38 years of my life. And, I finally got to a point after Florida where I decided to take action and be impactful. It is our responsibility to oversee governmental functions. And this being the core function of a democracy, the fairness, the fundamental fairness of the vote and the accuracy of the count, that's our responsibility. We're the ones that are supposed to be doing the checks and balances over our government. So we shouldn't be pointing fingers. What we should be doing is taking meaningful action. And I believe that's what Vote Watch is trying to do. And I hope other folks take that to heart. This is not a time for emotional outbursts. This is a time for serious investigation into our system to get to a point where we have a level of transparency so we have that confidence. And I think we're on that road. I think the questions that people are asking are fair. I'm a little bit concerned that, you know, some folks have an agenda to try and make one person the president over the other. I think this issue should supersede or is larger than politics itself. And I would like to see more folks step away from the partisanship portion of this, get to the same side of the table and realize that our whole system falls apart if we lose faith in this institution, the institution of elections.
Well, just in a closing in the last minute, Stephen Hertzberg, it would seem to me that a part of the 9/11 Commission, you know, they're trying to reform the intelligence system, et cetera, but it seems to me that inevitably in this country we're going to have a national ID card because of the global war on terror. And it would seem to me that this would be an opportunity, if it's an inevitability, and you can't, you know, a lot of civil libertarians don't like the idea of it, but maybe the silver lining could be if you have a national ID card, it ought to be able to entitle you to vote simply and easily. You don't have to register. You can go to anywhere and vote like they do in the rest of the world. Is that something worth considering?
Here's my viewpoint on how we solve the problem. I'll just try and make this quick. I'm an engineer. When you're an engineer, you develop a list of requirements of what you need to build a system, and then you allow a number of different designers to compete for various solutions. So I can imagine there are probably dozens of very good solutions that will solve our problem. But we need to understand what the problem is and what we need to solve it. Then let the designers figure out the best way to implement that. And so I'm not a big proponent of one solution or another. I'm a big proponent of finding out what it is we need in general terms, you know, and then allowing the experts to develop the specifics. So whether your option is the best or, you know, a dozen others, I don't know. We'll get there, but we'll only get there after we have the science to support a thorough set of election requirements.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Stephen Hertzberg.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Stephen Hertzberg, who's the founder of VoteWatch.us. And I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, and Carol Coote, the assistant producer. This program and previous ones are available at ianmasters.org. That's ianmasters.org.